My name is Brian Bonsenauer. I'm from the University of Wisconsin, where I'm teaching, and from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where I'm living now. One of the first books I remember running across that really sort of spoke to me of that was a book by Teilhard de Chardin called The Phenomenon of Man, where he speaks. Chardin was a French anthropologist earlier in the century who spoke and wrote, he was also a priest, and spoke and wrote about our origins, and specifically about evolution, the connection between evolution and the creation story found in Genesis here. More deeply, though, I think it was Chardin's openness to thinking about where we come from, that question, and using many different perspectives, using his scientific perspective, using his deep faith in God, and from that, thinking, asking new questions about where we come from, thinking about that in new ways. And as I sort of grew up in the scientific perspective, the Western scientific worldview kind of came to me as a package deal. This is the way it is. This is how you think about it. But over time, it's kind of come that there, even within the scientific perspective, there are different ways of thinking about things. And a joke that I heard this morning, I think, sort of captures that. So I want to share that with you. To quote my source, this was Marion. What's Marion's last name?
Vincent.
And she let me borrow this joke here for this morning. So it goes like this. There are three scientists sitting and watching a house. Now they know, they absolutely know that the house is empty. No one is in the house. As they sit and watch the house, they see two people go into the house. They wait for a while, watching the house this whole time, never taking their eyes off of it. And after a while, three people come out of the house. Well, one of the scientists is a physicist. And she says, our initial assumptions must have been wrong. There must have been another person in that house. Another of the scientists is a biologist. And he says, no, when they were in the house, they reproduced. Now there are three instead of two. The third scientist is a mathematician. She says, no, you both got it wrong. If we get another person to go back into the house, then there'll be no one in the house. Took a little while for it to sink in for me, too. But I think that the underlying part of that joke is that even within the scientific perspective, even within this worldview that sort of comes down as the truth and the package that that is the way it is, there are different ways of thinking about things, different ways of looking at things. And as I started learning more about the story of our origins from the scientific perspective, that impression started to grow more and more within me, that there are different ways of thinking about the story of creation, this Big Bang that happened 15 billion years ago. Just to emphasize that again, that some of the reading that I've been doing about this has really pointed out to me that within that thinking about the story of creation, sometimes people look at things and see something, and someone else can look at it and see something completely different. And here's a little cartoon that illustrates that. It starts, maybe I'll block this off for you here so you can do it in order here. I think I'll go together. There are two, physicists standing here at an observatory looking out into the night sky, and then all of a sudden, this comes up. Then it goes away. Then it comes up again. And one of the scientists says to the other, I don't care what it looks like, they're pulsars. So here's these two scientists experiencing reality, this reality out there, and seeing in it sort of what they need to see. I don't care what it looks like, they're pulsars. Of course, someone else might see something very different in there, which is the point of that cartoon. So some of the real interesting writing that I've stumbled upon with this is work by Brian Swim and Thomas Berry. This book here called The Universe Story, which I want to tell you another story from this morning. It's called From the Primordial Flaring Forth to the Ecozoic Era, a celebration of the unfolding of the cosmos. Now, Brian Swim is a mathematical cosmologist. It's a big title. I sort of love that title. When I first heard it, I thought, ooh, I want to be one of those. But what a mathematical cosmologist does is they think about the beginnings, the origin of the universe, from thinking about models of how the universe, what we know about physics now, and extrapolating that back to the conditions at the beginning of the universe, and thinking about what must the origin of the universe been like by what we can see about the way the universe interacts with us today. But Brian Swim, in his talks with Thomas Berry, who is hard to categorize, just a very unique person. He's an ecologist, a monk, many different things, but very focused on thinking about an ecological perspective of life. And in Brian Swim's conversations with him and talking with him, they've developed or are developing, are thinking about the origin of the universe in a new way. And the way that they're approaching it is by thinking about stories. Okay, thinking about stories. So let me tell you another story here. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. 15 million years ago, in a great flash, the universe flared forth into being. In each drop of existence, a primordial energy blazed with an intensity never to be equaled again. Thick with its power, the universe billowed out in every direction, so that the elemental particles could stabilize, enabling the first atomic beings of hydrogen and helium to emerge. After a million turbulent years, the frenzied particles calmed themselves enough for the primeval fireball to dissolve into a great scattering, with all the atoms soaring away from each other into the dark cosmic skies, opening up in the beginning of time. A billion years of uninterrupted night enabled the universe to prepare itself for its next macrocosmic transfiguration. In the depths of its silence, the universe shuddered with the immense creative necessity to fashion the galaxies. The Andromeda Galaxy, the Virgo, Pegasus, Fornax, the Magellanic Clouds, M33, the Coma Cluster, Sculptor, the Hercules Cluster, as well as our own Milky Way Galaxy. 100 billion galaxies in all.
These gigantic structures pinwheeled through the emptiness of space and swept up all the hydrogen and helium into self-organizing systems. And clusters of systems. And clusters of systems. Each galaxy presented its unique form to the universe. Each contained its own internal dynamics. Each brought forth from its own material billions and billions and billions of primal stars. The most brilliant stars rushed through their natural sequence of transformations and exploded in colossal supernovas that matched a billion stars in luminosity and spewed stellar material throughout the galaxy. New stars formed out of the materials that had been created in this process of stellar nucleosynthesis. Second generation stars were richer in potential and more complex in internal structures because the primal stars had created the elemental beings of carbon, nitrogen, molybdenum, oxygen, calcium, magnesium, and all the other 100 elements. Some 5 billion years after the beginning of time, the star Tiamat emerged in our spiral galaxy. Tiamat knit together wonders in its fiery belly and then sacrificed itself, carving its body up in a supernova explosion that dispersed this new elemental power in all directions so that the adventure might deepen. Five billion years ago, after the universe had expanded and developed for 10 billion years, our Milky Way galaxy shocked a peaceful drifting cloud of Tiamat's remnants into giving birth to 10,000 new stars. Some of these turned out to be diminutive brown dwarf stars. Others became blue supergiants that quickly flashed into the incandescence of new supernovas. Others became stable, long-burning yellow stars, and still others became shimmering red stars. The universe, insisting upon diversity, also brought forth from this floating cloud of elements our own star, the Sun. Once granted existence, the Sun showed its own self-organizing abilities, blasting off nearly all the clouds of elements yet hovering about it, and spinning the rest into a multi-banded disk of matter out of which arose the bonded system of the Sun, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. The charged early planets boiled as molten and gaseous materials. On Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Pluto, chemical combinations slowly grew to become rocks and continents and planetary crusts that eventually so dominated the dynamics that all significant creativity came to an end. On Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, and Uranus, chemical creativity never advanced beyond simpler compounds, and they continue to churn primarily as gases for billions of years. On Earth, due to the balance of its own internal dynamics and its position in the structure of the solar system, matter existed as solid, liquid, and gas, and flowed from one form into another to provide an incessantly creative chemical womb. From this womb, the first living cell, Aries, arose 4 billion years ago. The primal cells, the prokaryotes, had the power to organize themselves, as did the stars and galaxies, but they had stunning new gifts as well. The cells could remember significant information, even including patterns necessary to knit together other living cells. Cells also possessed a new order of creativity, allowing them to fashion a chemical glove to catch packets of energy hurled by the sun at the speed of light, to transform these glowing quantas into food. Now, spiral galaxies have the power to bring forth stars perpetually, but some of the planets that emerged from these blossomed for a time only to have their significant advances grind to a halt, as in the case of Jupiter and the other planets circling the sun. Even in those cauldrons of creativity where the universe continues to unfold for billions of years, such as the living planet Earth, all significant development can cease, as almost took place 2 billion years ago. Aries and her descendants, the prokaryotes, by gathering their hydrogen from the ocean, using those packets of solar energy, released oxygen into the Earth's system. The Earth slowly saturated the land, the oxygen slowly saturated the land, the atmosphere, and the seas. By altering Earth's chemistry with this element of explosive power, the prokaryotes unknowingly pushed Earth's system into an extremely unstable condition, one beyond their own capacity to endure. In time, the dominant prokaryote communities perished as their interiors were set ablaze by the oxygen. But out of this crisis, threatening the very viability of the living planet, arose Vaikengla, a new and radically advanced creature. Vaikengla, the first eukaryote cell, was fully capable not only of enduring oxygen, but shaping oxygen's dangerous energy for its own purposes. It seethed with creativity. The eukaryotes invented meiotic sex, and the universe's diversity expanded 100-fold, as now two genetically different beings could unite and fashion out of their genetic endowments a radically new being. Eukaryotes also invented the habit of eating living beings, and thus deepened the community of Earth not only with the intimacy of sexual bonding, but also with the intimacy associated with ecosystems, predators and prey relationships. Finally, at the end of the period during which they were the most advanced organisms in the Earth system, the eukaryotes took the daring step of submerging themselves into a larger being. Trillions of them gathered together and evoked Argus, the first multicellular animal. 600 million years ago, multicellular organisms arose with a variety of qualitatively distinct body plans. They included the coral worms, insects, clams, starfish, sponges, spiders, vertebrates, leeches, and other forms that went extinct. Life in the mesocosm had begun. Worms learned to wiggle in the oceans and invented the tooth when another creature invented the shell. Ocean waves left sea plants stranded on the rocks. Unable to crawl home, they instead invented the wood cell and learned to stand up straight as lycopod trees that lived along the shores of oceans and rivers, and that in turn transformed themselves into gymnosperm trees, capable of covering entire continents with life. The animals followed the plants onto the land, and soon the continents had been floating lifelessly on Earth's mantle for 2 billion years, heaved with amphibians and reptiles and insects and the great dinosaurs with gleaming eyes reaching up to the sunlit leaves of the forest canopy. All this creativity taking place within Earth depended upon many different stabilities, including the sun's stable burning of hydrogen, Earth's stable revolution about the sun, the stability of many quintillion chemical bonds throughout the Earth system. But the galaxy is an immense home, and disasters regularly visit the Earth. Most poignantly, when other heavenly bodies collide with Earth and its delicate fabric of life. 67 million years ago, astronomical collisions so changed Earth's atmosphere and climates that nearly all forms of animal life had to reinvent themselves or perish. Mass extinctions meant many animals followed the dinosaurs into their graves. But such destruction also opened up new possibilities, which were seized upon by the birds and the mammals and the insects, among others, who proliferated and fluoresced in the wake of the disaster. When the mammals entered Earth's life 200 million years ago, they developed emotional sensitivity, a new capacity within their nervous systems. Throughout the mammalian existence, and especially during the last 67 million years of the Cenozoic era, the beauty and the terror of the world, the brilliance of birds' plumage, the intoxicating display of the flowers, the luminosity of the fruits, and the frights of the forest at night, the archetypal strength of the mother-infant bond, left a deep impress on the psychic nature of all the mammals. From the whales, the rodents, the sea lions, the bats, the elephants, the porcupines, the horses, the shrews, the deer, the chimpanzees, and the humans. In rare instances among the most advanced mammals, especially among the primates, the mammalian emotional sensitivity was deepened with another neural capability, conscious self-awareness. Empowered with both, the human probed for its own distinct niche within the enveloping Earth community. The scientific story of creation. But maybe as you haven't heard it before, certainly as I had not heard it before, how a different perspective on thinking about the same series of events, the same knowns and unknowns, but making meaning from them in different ways. In fact, I think stories are about meaning making, and if you've ever thought about how
how embedded we are in stories. Movies, what are they? Stories. Books, many books are stories. Our history is a series of stories. Religion is built on a series of stories. We tell stories to make meaning out of the world. And part of that is to make meaning out of our origins. So this new story, the story of creation from a scientific perspective, is really very new. In the history of humanity, it's only been the tiniest moment since we have come to understand the story of creation in this way, a new story of creation. And with this story, I think one of the fundamental realizations of this story is the connectedness of everything. That all creation, everything, you, me, plants, the sun, the galaxies, the skin in your hand when you pinch it, the feeling of pinching your hand, the emotional response to seeing your family, the wonder at experiencing something new, the beauty of these mountains around us, all of those things from physical, mental, emotional, came out of the very tiniest pinprick at the beginning of the universe. From that smallest point grew out all of these things. And so that we're all connected in a much deeper way than we thought before, than we could even imagine before. This is one of the sort of the revelations from this new story, but there are others, there are many others, in fact, many that have not been discovered yet or realized yet or spoken yet. And many that you hold, I think, in your experiences and in your life, from your wonder at the beauty of creation and wonder at the origin, where it all comes from, what does it all mean? I'd like to take some time to explore those a little bit by having you reflect with another person on this story of creation. And so maybe if you could pair up with another person in just a second, I'd ask you to pair up with someone who you may not know and introduce yourself first of all. And then I'll write this question up on the board, but just listen to it for right now. The question for reflection that I wanted to start with was, how does the story of the universe make you feel? Does the story of the universe make you feel small, insignificant, tiny blip? Or does it suggest a new significance for your life? What are feelings are evoked by the story of the universe? So think on that for just a minute. I'll write it up on the board here. Jen, how does this story of the origin of the universe make you feel? So some reflections on that, things that came up from your discussion that you'd like to share? Get us started.
We thought that may feel pretty insignificant if you think that everything on the earth is related to everything else. If it all came from one point. And laying out outside at night, looking up at the stars, and you just start realizing that we're just a little grain of sand out here floating around. If everything came from one point, if you believe the Big Bang and all that, then we're related to everything. Mm-hmm. To the wood here, to shoes I'm wearing,
right,
to rocks,
right,
to everything.
Right.
We're all related.
Yeah. And so out of that was kind of a feeling of insignificance that came out of that?
Well,
maybe a feeling of being very small and vast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Insignificant, but we're all related. So.
Okay, insignificant and related.
Yeah. Insignificant but significant.
So, in the fact that we're related, that. So maybe it's the fact that we're related to everything else that's where our significance lies.
Exactly. Hmm.
Yeah. Oh, great, thank you. Other perspectives out of that?
I keep wondering how come, this is not the question that came up, but can we ever have not enough oxygen in this universe? I know they talk about CO2, but that just came into my mind.
Right.
How does that balance? And when we talk about the trees disappearing and stuff, that came to mind as you were talking.
Well, the oxygen in this story is an interesting place because, in fact, the oxygen was first a waste product, a byproduct of the photosynthesis going on in the early oceans. And the oxygen level built to such a degree that things that would actually spontaneously combust, you know, the interior of the cells would just burst into fire.
So we can't,
because there was so much oxygen. Yeah, 21% is about the level of the oxygen content in the atmosphere. If you get much higher than that, just a little bit higher, a few percentage higher than that, things start to just burst into flame. No. Trees,
what?
Buildings.
What's in this balance when there's so much going on, and we say the trees are disappearing, and then once it may go again?
It's this relationship. I mean, that question is a profound question. What keeps us in balance? There's not a real answer to that. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about that very question. The history of the universe, if it says anything, it says that there are these moments in the history of the universe that are just like the eye of a needle. I mean, things could, if they had been just slightly differently, forget it. You know? I mean, we would not be here talking about it right now. Just, I mean, millions of 1% different. If the rate of expansion of the universe had been 1 trillionth of 1% different, we would not be here.
How do you know that?
That's from these mathematical models of looking at how the universe has come to be.
This is where I would object to your initial beginning of the story, which God created the Big Bang and stood back and let it happen. I can't feature that these fine distinctions have come and gone, fallen into the pattern they are without some discrimination.
That's interesting. Now, did anyone else sort of see God's hand in the midst of that?
Yeah.
I mean, when I read this story, I see the hand of God, the Spirit of God hovering over the face of the deep everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, and it just jumps out.
In the story, you bring it in at only one point, and that's the very beginning.
You
have things inventing things themselves. Mm-hmm. In your own mind, you may not be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But as you tell the story, at least as I heard it,
mm-hmm.
you have things happening by themselves, which I see.
Well, again, this is the story. This is Brian Swift's story. Go ahead.
That's very biblical, though, because even in the Bible it says, and God said, let the earth bring forth whatever. You know, he didn't say tree, cow, whatever. He said, let the earth bring forth. Mm-hmm. So that's how God worked. That's very biblical. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
I think what you read was absolutely right on target, mm-hmm. as far as we understand it.
Mm-hmm. Other perspectives about sort of God in the midst of the story, or feelings?
I have the one comment that would be related. I think everything basically comes from carbon, and that photosynthesis process, it makes sense to me too, because we take the carbon dioxide and change it, and one of the outputs of that is carbon, or oxygen that everybody needs, and everything makes to subsist. But to me, I don't have a problem accepting the Genesis story with the scientific. I'm not sure if the scientific is proven at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I think
mm-hmm.
scientists are wrong, and they can still be wrong, and other things are happening that we're guessing at, and we don't really know. But I think the Genesis story bridges over that and generalizes that,
mm-hmm.
because to me, go back in time, and I've read that what we didn't understand relate to a religious or relate to God and some of his things that he did, but it's some simple things that we don't understand, like why the sun comes up right when it does at the same time every year. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty simplistic in the olden days, but it was something that was made religious in those times. I think, to me, you explained that then as generalizing. And I can see where the scientific part we were talking about fits into that, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure that we explained it correctly at this point.
I like I forget where I heard this first, but in talking about stories, one of my favorite perspectives on that is beginning to tell a story. The storyteller will often say, I don't know if it happened this way, but I know that it's true. So the distinction between what actually happened, what we can say we know about what happened, and a truth that's sort of held within it. And I think you can use that to tell the story, to tell the Genesis story, and to tell this story. And absolutely correct, the scientific story is not figured out. It's not written down somewhere. It's being discovered and uncovered as we move along. So it's a good perspective to keep in mind as you hear these other perspectives on how you feel listening to that story.
Yeah. I got the feeling of how miraculous it was that we're here and we're breathing and all these processes are just so incredible. It really filled me with awe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard someone saying it made me sort of look at things, in a new way. I look at the grain of the wood. And think about the grain of the wood and the contours of my skin and sort of a new awareness. I think for me that was, so out of this sort of miraculous sense comes for me a new awareness of creation. I mean, sort of being in this valley, it's hard not to have a new awareness of creation. Other feelings. Thank you.
Yeah, I was gonna say I'm not troubled by the way scientists don't necessarily posit an active moment where God maybe intervenes to make that little niche possible, because most of a lot of us, at least if there's an automobile accident, for instance, and somebody that I love is harmed, I think of that as the result of our freedom, the fact that we live in a world where there are certain existing laws, and God gave us that freedom. And I think we need to apply that same thing to creation. By creating, God, in a sense, gave some freedom to the creation that he made. He doesn't abandon it, he remains present to it, but he has given it an existence of its own and its own freedom, and it is going to continue to go the direction that he accepted it. I don't think we need to always say, well, at that point, God must have had his finger there.
It's
maybe it does just boom, and it was just right at the beginning the way it's supposed to turn out,
I mean,
let's give the creation an integrity, the integrity that God gave to it, and let the scientists kind of discover the fingerprints of God in the midst of that. That's where the awe comes in, is that when we look at those things, how amazing that over all that time God allowed that to happen.
Mm-hmm. I think I keep thinking of the mystery of it all. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're a person that can accept a little mystery and not don't have to have all the exact answers, this doesn't really cause a problem. It really doesn't with me. I've always felt like this is quite interesting to hear about things like that. Right. Even as I heard the Bible story, there is something we don't understand. We don't need to necessarily for practicing our faith.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful point. I mean, when if you ask a scientist where the universe came from, and the scientist replies from the Big Bang or from this primordial flaring forth, I mean, what is that? That's mystery. We don't know what that is. We don't know why that happens. I mean, there's a deep mystery underlying all origin stories, but maybe in the biggest way underlying the origin story of the universe. It's one of the, I mean, it's a deep mystery, and it's just the mystery of it is is very open to reflection and just sitting with that mystery and letting that mystery kind of soak in. For me, that's been one of the wonders of discovering this story, is just allowing it to kind of soak in, and the mystery of at the base of the story. Yeah.
This is sort of a different question, and maybe my amateurishness as a kind of a person who keeps an interest in science shows here, but one of the ways that the age of the universe is determined is by the redshift of light moving away from us. Recently I read that gravity bends light. Mm-hmm. How do we know that the light hasn't simply been curved in back upon itself and is much newer than we think it is?
Well, there's certainly, open questions in science.
It's a mystery.
Yeah. Are physicists wrestling with that question? How do they correct for the bending of gravity?
If light bends
with gravity, light's going by all kinds of objects in a system.
It's a very slight bend, speaking from my physics background. Mm-hmm. It's usually, you only notice that type of bend or an optical effect on light if you have like a star directly behind another large star, or right. A massive star. It's a very slight bend, so it's not, you're not likely to get this type of thing. Now, there is some very, very bizarre theories in the universe, being a Mobius-type strip universe or something like that. Okay. But those are out there a ways. the light's not going to loop back on itself, that type of thing.
Okay. Yeah, the other perspective that brings up is that there are lots of sort of competing theories for the universe, and really out of all of those, the kind of the place to look, and from my perspective, is to kind of look to sort of what seems simplest, what seems to make help make things simpler. And in fact, that's sort of at the basis of thinking about science, is if you have two theories that are competing, choose the one that's simpler. It's just the perspective. I mean, the other one may be right, and we can never really say what's right out of the scientific. We can only say sort of what the observation is. But what I think that this story does, what it helps me to do, is to start to think about making meaning out of this scientific story, to make meaning out of this new creation story. And to do that by reading the story, by thinking about the story, reflecting on it, and thinking about it in my own life, also by art, poetry, song. Just out of our worship the other day, worship's another way I found in making meaning out of it. The call to worship, a couple of lines in there were just, I thought they were written out of this session. In the beginning, God guided the darkness over the earth, leading it into light, forming a communion from the chaos. A sense of deep communion out of this chaos. This was in the one we celebrated yesterday. God gave us the...
No, Ray McKeever's.
Ray McKeever's. Yeah, the call to worship there. We're almost out of time. Let me just maybe give you some suggestions for reflecting more on this story, the story of our origin. My first suggestion would be to learn more about the story, to learn more about the story of our origin, the story of the cosmos. There are a number of books and video series coming out now that are helpful in doing that. Again, I mentioned the work of Brian Swim and Thomas Berry in this book, The Universe Story. They have it over in the bookstore. There's a couple other books I noticed over there as well, and I have those titles. I'll just read some of them to you. A couple by Brian Swim, The Universe is a Green Dragon, which is a wonderful sort of, just in story form, just walks through the creation of the universe. A new book that he's just put out, The Hidden Heart of the Cosmos. It's a little bit smaller than this one, again, kind of in story form. might be interesting to some of you. A book by Konian, Earth Story, Sacred Story, and some work of Chardin, who I mentioned before. There's The Phenomenon of Man and Evolution and Christianity, some of his work. There are also video series about, and I can talk with you more about that if you're interested. But the story is no longer, you no longer have to pick up a physics textbook and, get into the equations and understand Maxwell's equations about light and think about special relativity to understand the story. There's a lot of work being done now to make the story accessible for us, and to talk about, to reflect on the meaning of the story. So I would encourage you to do that, learn more about the story. The other thing that's been helpful for me is to reflect on my own origin, and to reflect on my origin as story, to think about the where I come from, that question, to think about it as story, as a mythical story or a biblical story, to kind of write my own story of my creation. That can be sort of a medium for thinking about your origin and the origin of the universe and how those come together, our insignificance and our significance, our miraculous nature, to give us a new awareness of creation, the integrity of the creation, and the mystery of it all. So thank you very much. If there are questions, we can. I'm going to be around, and we'll be doing more sort of topics on this. Other talks about this sort of going into different aspects, taking different aspects of this story in the next week and next couple of weeks. So I'd be happy to talk with you whenever. Thank you.